Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's Mad Tech podcast. I'm Rachel Smith, COO with ExchangeWire. Joining us here today in the studio is our very special guest, Simon Housted, Senior Director, Exchanges and Publisher with Verizon Media. Hello, Simon.
Good morning, everybody.
Good to have you here. And, of course, a big hello to our CEO, Kieran O'Kane.
Hello.
How's it going, Kieran?
It's going great.
Good to see that you've put your mobile phone down for a couple of minutes.
Yeah,
I've stopped
using the mobile phone.
I feel special
right yes. now. Really.
Well, Simon's here.
You've got him paying attention already, Simon. This is, definitely special treatment.
There's a picture of Gordon Ramsay on the fucking screen here.
A bit of targeted advertising for
is
you.
Is it, right? Two banner ads, so we've got a stopwatch to make sure I don't talk too much.
Keep us on time, which is the hardest job, frankly, like listeners, as you'll be aware.
Two advertisings of Gordon Ramsay with Don't Compromise.
Yeah, they're really bad banner ads, aren't they?
Terrible. It's like two banner ads underneath each other.
Wow. Really bad.
Really
the
going for
ad.
The monetization on that site.
Yeah. Great. Let's get cracking then. Okay. First news story of the week is the news that was released earlier this week that BritBox is coming to the UK. So this is a collaboration between ITV and the BBC. It's an SVOD service featuring, the press reports tell us, largely archived material from the BBC and ITV. But there will also be some original content made available as well over time. There's indications that other broadcasters in the UK will join. It's of course a service that they launched in the US back in 2017, but now they're bringing it here to the UK. So really, really interesting. A lot of things to talk about here. I've got a number of questions for you guys. I guess the first is that this is obviously closely related to the earlier iteration of this collaboration, which was called Project Kangaroo, but was blocked by the competition regulator. And that was, they tried to set that up back in 2008. And there's been a lot of discussion that was a bit of a moment in time, and it enabled a segue for the likes of Netflix and others to come into the streaming market and dominate. So interested in general in your views on this and interested in the machinations of what it means for subscription services, for streaming and SVOD. Simon, let's start with you.
So it's a hugely interesting move, right? And probably I'd start with, I really want it to be successful. I think good, well-produced content, finding a route to market for monetization is everyone's desire. And at Verizon Media, we're a publisher, we're a tech company, but actually we're a publisher by our DNA. So we want people to be rewarded for producing good content. Within that, I think definitely the Project Kangaroo was a real moment in time, and it was a big, long, drawn-out battle, right? But if you think about the world of 2008 versus 18, but 19... Just think about how digital has impacted your whole life. I plugged my phone into my car this morning to listen to the last podcast on my way into work, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we weren't thinking of doing that 10 years ago. So what felt like a competitive challenge then is a really different marketplace now. The challenge, though, is it's also 10 years later and there are other people in market. Yeah. There are already other subscription
Hotly
services.
Competitive, isn't it?
Mm. And I guess the challenge becomes about individuals' tolerance to pay and where their preference for payment are. So I think that's a really interesting opportunity. A lot of publishers are looking to develop subscription services, subscription versions. Look at the Guardian model, which is hugely successful in terms of a donation-led subscription model.
Beg and bowl.
Right?
Monetization,
I wouldn't quite go that far.
Yeah, or donation-led might be the other way to describe
ball.
That.
Donation-led is, I think, the polite phrase.
No, it's a beg and bowl. It's embarrassing.
So I think, again, using subscription services are good. Differentiation from subscription from your free services is good. The license fee area will be just challenging around regulation and what they're able to distribute as content.
Yeah.
But I genuinely hope it's successful. And then, you know, it's about people's tolerance to pay. And I run far too many subscription services already. What's the value for me? It's a value exchange.
This is it. And at some point, you're going to like be totting up, right? All the subscriptions that you're paying out on a monthly basis. And you're also then going to be doing a bit of an inventory of what you're accessing where. So we've got to imagine that some of the BBC content that's been available through Netflix won't be available through Netflix if this really, you know, takes off and does well. So you're going to be looking at where you can get what you want to access, and you will be making decisions about which subscription services you'll go for and which you won't, right?
There's a lot of interesting stuff to come in the next 12 months with the Disney subscription service, which is actually pulling a load of content out.
I don't think. Look, there was a very interesting conversation with the Captify chairman. Camera's name Tom. His last name.
You know the guy. Can't help you. I do know the guy you're talking about.
I apologize, Tom. I just can't remember your last name. But he was on CNBC and he basically said that Netflix has won that streaming wars. Right. He was totting up how much Disney have to invest in this and how many subscribers they have. And even if Disney pull out all that content, right? So you've got the franchise, Star Wars, Marvel, right? Pretty big franchises. But people are not going to Netflix to watch this stuff, right? They're going to watch Netflix-produced content, most of it. There is a lot of third parties on there, but let's be honest, when we're having our conversations and what I'm watching Netflix is the stuff that Netflix are making, right?
So that's the really interesting area, right? Is well, that they have said they will be looking at producing, their own content, right? So original content. And what I'm wondering is, are they really going to have the budgets to be competing with the likes of Netflix, who are clearly throwing an awful lot of money at original content?
How much does this cost? I'd like to see the economics of this. How much does it cost, right?
That's another interesting.
Running it, right? And how much do they need to make it profitable? As Simon says, and you says, we're reaching a peak or a sort of fatigue, right? Subscription fatigue, particularly around content. How many subscription models or packages can you subscribe to? And also, why are we paying a TV license if the BBC is making money off content? Like, this is going to bring up a whole bunch of conversations, right? One is the TV license. Why am I paying for this when I'm paying the TV license, right? There's going to be all that sort of thing. And then, obviously, all these different parties together on one streaming platform, how much revenue do they need to make it profitable for the rest of it, right?
Yeah.
Obviously, they're still going to have free-to-air and they're still going to have their ad-funded model. I mean, ITV made $500 million in profit last year. That's insane. That's an amazing business. But how much will this move the needle for these content producers? And while I agree with Simon about it's great to see these come together, how many streaming services are we going to need? Like, Disney's going to come into the market now, right? Take all the Disney shows and all the rest. But their addressable market is so much smaller than Netflix. Like, not, I couldn't give a shit about Disney. All right, you know, I see Star Wars in the cinema, but if you've got a family, I can see the rationale. But then BBC is for kids is free, so why would you pay for Disney a Disney channel? There'll be a certain segment. I think there's a lot of streaming channels thinking they're going to have the same kind of heft and scale as Netflix. Netflix have won, right? They have 180 million subscribers and they're going to be 300 million in about 3 years. They've won the war on that thing. And I'm kind of wondering if this is a waste of money because...
So I'm going to come against it.
Of course, that's the whole point of this show.
Nothing ever lasts forever, right?
I was going to say, the winners are never always at the top, right?
So all of those things can be disrupted and changed. And a little bit to your point about Netflix, how much did they pay to renew that Friends deal for another year? Right, because actually, terribly, what a lot of people do on Netflix is binge watch things like Friends. So if your content pool is good enough and your subscription pricing is right, there is still an opportunity. What I think is a challenge is, you know, using this as an example. Okay, I might add that subscription service to get that content, but I won't pay another $6.99. I won't pay 10 $6.99s to get to my depth of content. But when we think about cord cutting or that move to OTT, you know, actually, if I can start to cherry pick some of those subscriptions rather than buy my big bulk subscription from Sky, maybe there is some flexibility. Mm-hmm. The Now TV model to a degree, and even that has some inbuilt pricing into it. So I don't think it's ever definite in the same way. I do think it's going to be complicated because of license fee and public service requirements for the BBC, but I've certain there is good content they can produce out there. I mean, actually, things like Luther have been massive successes on BBC America, actually, and on services like Netflix.
Yeah.
Do you think this is a global thing as well? I mean, is it just UK based, or are they going out internationally? Because I guess they have deals, like ITV probably have deals with different broadcasters globally, right? This won't be available in Holland or Germany or whatever, like, you know.
There'll be distribution models. There always are with TV rights. Verizon Media represents some of the NFL media in the US, right, as a streaming partner. It's hugely successful for us. A lot of live streaming, a lot of OTT.
I am interested to see where this goes. Because
I think it's also...
Sports is an interesting one, right? So the Major League Baseball have their own channel as a very successful streaming channel. So at what stage does the Premiership say, look, we're going to take this all in-house because we can get more money from a global audience, and we keep it. And what does that mean for Sky? Because Sky's entire model is based around Premiership rights, right? They use that as a battering ram for us to subscribe to their channels. And it's quite interesting that these models now are becoming more palatable. Because I actually subscribe to the Gaelic football subscription on a global basis. So I see every game streamed. And like a lot of people watch baseball and hockey and basketball. So when there's rugby or when there's particularly the Premiership, because it's so popular globally.
Look at the ESPN sports rights, right? And in boxing, and I don't know if any of you guys follow boxing, but heavyweight boxing, marquee event, marquee boxing championship. Three leading players right now split across three networks. The deal with Anthony Joshua is to launch the ESPN, I think it's the ESPN one, streaming service. Right, that's not
so using him as a star.
They're using him as part of that launch, right? And so he's a five fight deal or a 3-year deal. I can't remember the deal. So maybe that one's actually Fury, but three different companies using that as the gateway to bring people in. And I think you'll see some changes with sports rights, with things like maybe collective bargaining ending to a degree. So actually, no longer the Premier League benefiting the rights. Where will Manchester United start to sell their own rights?
Yeah.
Will they actually run their own streaming service? They run their own TV channel for a limited subscription.
So people would subscribe. I mean, you know, we've got some sports fans here in the studio. Our producer of the show is a sports
and
fan.
And some Spurs fans.
And would it be a case they would pay $7.99 a month to watch all Spurs games, right? So that would be interesting. And I think that this is kind of goes into the OTT discussion, like niche sporting events, like niche sports. That there's a huge opportunity here for sure.
Well, I think the point is about getting audience wherever it is that they feel that they can get that audience, and making and providing access to content that you either can't get anywhere else or has some unique element to it. Because that's the whole point as well of making their archived content available. Mm. Because there's huge audiences for those archived content pieces, but it's really difficult for them to, you know, they can't host it on iPlayer, BBC archived content, it's got a short window for viewing availability. So it's definitely about putting those two things together.
And is there any talk about this being ad funded, or is it all just sub?
There's so far from what I've read, there's no talk about it being ad funded. But connected to the conversation of why they're introducing a subscription service has been ITV saying that their advertising revenue has been reducing over the years.
Reducing or just plateauing?
Reducing was what I read.
I think, I mean, there's part of this is managing the shift to channel, right? The channel shift that's underway is the big driver. Where our audience is consuming, and therefore how can you effectively monetize? What's your point of contact with that partner? And actually, if you have a subscription service via the app and that viewership is on a phone, then you are holding people into that model. You may drive better monetization than monetizing that via an ad-funded model on a phone, right? Versus the traditional TV market. So the one thing I'd say, it's never an absolute, right? Unless Netflix are probably a good case where they came out with a non-ad-funded model and they still hold true to that. Mm. Lots of talk about Amazon and a funded ad model coming in, but Amazon is a bundle with Prime. For me, I think there'll be layers of service, and it's about where you choose to pay.
To participate, yeah.
There is some big audiences with expats and archives
absolutely.
As well.
But obviously they've got, like, the terrestrial channels still have a massive audience, and they have a lot of a lot of good titles, a lot of good programming. Like, you think about the soaps, you know, X Factor, all of that stuff. There's still a big, big audience for that, and maybe they're just chasing the audience. Maybe that's. But then I guess if they can get people 1 million, 2 million, 3 million to subscribe, which is not.
It's not insignificant.
It's not insignificant. Then that changes the revenue model of ITV. Then you've gone from like a pure ad-funded model to becoming almost like a SaaS model, right? So the valuation of the company actually starts increasing, because it's you're saying that's recurring income. Ad revenue is never predictable, because we don't know from one day to the next when the recession will hit, or, you know, when will be, you know, a bull market, or what happens after Brexit. So I guess for the actual economic models of Channel 4, Channel 5 and ITV, less so the BBC, that there is a really interesting sort of play there, because if they can get, look, okay, 3 million is conservative, right? Because there's 66 million people in the UK, and a lot of them watching terrestrial TV. If you can rope in a family, right, and have a family subscription, you could get to 6 or 7 million. There's no reason why. It could be as big as Netflix in the UK.
And then all you need, and then you use some of that money to start creating original content, and you just need a couple of hits that people want to watch.
Well,
the model will be really interesting just because of the BBC, where it's funded from, BBC Worldwide versus... Yeah. Yeah. BBC, I think that would be corporation in the UK.
Yeah, I think that'd be BBC worldwide content. So I'm sure there's some latitude for the BBC to kind of take that money and pay BBC Worldwide because it's archived
content. Yeah. It was also interesting. One of the articles I read was making a direct comparison between the cost of a TV license and the sort of kind of imagined cost of a service like this, because they were comparing it with what BritBox charge for access in the US, which is the equivalent of about £5 or something a month.
Mm-hmm.
And they were saying a TV license costs you a bit more than £6 a month. So people might actually make a choice and decide, well, I'm not going to get
well you've
a TV
got no
license.
Choice yep. you have no choice. If you have a TV in your front room, as long as you're
watching
pay
it
a license.
As long as you're watching it, but no, if all you're doing is streaming,
they still do you
if you just you know if you're streaming, if you're streaming, you now don't have to have a license.
If you don't have but if you are streaming BBC iPlayer, you need a license. But if you don't have a television set in your house, you don't have to pay a TV license.
But if you have a TV set in your house, right, and you have a Roku box, right, and you're just watching Roku, you don't have to pay a TV license.
Grey area, I'm not sure.
So we should confirm later.
Yeah.
But maybe
that's the evolution. There's a license discussion.
Well, this is it. Well, and they also talked about license fee revenue declining as well, because clearly they're not making a success of being able to collect license fees in the way that they once were. So
I think if you think this is a very long-term game, right, and there's a couple of things when I don't particularly want to talk about the license fee, it's a really complex business area, but there is some moves from the government politically through, I think, over 75s to not have to pay the license fee or something like that, an article moving forward. The younger generation, of which I am certainly not, so,
Simon.
But actually for transient 20-year-olds, 20 to 30-year-olds who don't own a home and not so fixed, not owning a fixed TV license, just streaming becomes much more of a model. So don't think of this as a one-year, two-year revenue play. Think of it as a 20, 30-year play. And I think ongoing licensee renegotiation, you can see why the model makes sense to build out and test.
Absolutely.
Every publisher I know, be they a radio publisher, be they a radio station, be they a TV producer, be they a publisher, just a digital publisher, be they just a blog, are looking for ways to diversify revenue. You guys are a great example, right? With Wiredex, right? With events and event strategies. Everyone is looking at ways to mitigate, that's not the right word, to diversify revenue stream for some consistency.
Absolutely.
And a bit to your point, to risk absorption as well, ad funded,
particularly
in the modern world, you can, as an independent publisher, be at risk of an algorithmic change.
Yeah.
And
there's been a few cases of that.
There's been some cases of that. And so suddenly your revenue is very much halved. So if you can diversify revenue as a publisher, that's a good thing for your business. You just have to have a service that gives value.
And I
think your point about unique content or original content.
Yeah. And this it's a content play. And I think Netflix have trained behavior around
the market. I agree. Moving on to the next story. Thanks, Kieran. Oh, geez. Are you the anchor? Yeah, no. It's always hard to tell.
You called me a wanker.
Most definitely not.
Yeah.
Okay, second news story of the day is about Challenger DTC brand Third Love, just completing a successful fundraiser of $55 million US. In an effort to expand their product offering and the technology that it uses to produce customized sizing for better fitting bras. That's what Third Love does. So they're looking to expand their selling footprint, moving into new markets, but they're also adding new product lines such as swimwear, and they are improving and adding on to the technology tools that they're using that create these kind of bespoke sizing options for women buying bras. Fascinating DTC brand. We love talking about DTC brands. Really interesting fundraising round. A lot of very high profile people contributing to that funding, including CEO of YouTube and former AOL CEO Tim Armstrong through his new company DTX. So I just wanted to hear your thoughts on this. It struck me as a really interesting story for many reasons. It's obviously got that direct-to-consumer angle, the data angle, the technology angle. But it also strikes me that it's an example of how this is completely upsetting the sort of supply chain and the manufacturing chain as well. So I'm interested in your views on that. And I suppose, you know, it would be good to have a bit of an ad tech angle to this. What does it say about combining that really powerful customer data with technology layer? Simon, to you first.
So DTC, super interesting, really complex when you think about changes to manufacturer. You guys with Danny a couple of weeks ago talked about Harry's Razors and then, I mean, talk about investment. They're investing in plants and they're investing in plants locally to produce, to meet a quality bar. They're identifying a gap in the market. Specific to Third Love, that market is an entirely enormous market.
Yep. Underserved as well.
Underserved, and there's definitely optimization for customization. There's quite a lot in clothing brand space about actual better customization for sizes. A really interesting DTC brand, sort of, but not maybe in the way we often talk about it, is Contra, which is part of the Parkrun movement, which is trying to make athletic clothing for people of all sizes, right? An inclusive movement, and it's a little bit tied to inclusive movements and community movements that support some of this much greater relationship with customers. So for the brand, I see the value in being able to understand that audience and data and understand how to target and drive that. I think Europe and GDPR always makes this super interesting, but the ability to have a direct relationship is so critical for them to develop forward and actually to work out what customers want, to engage in that process. I mean, fashion, clothing is an industry that is constantly disrupted throughout history, right? Look at the high street 5 years ago versus 10 years ago. Look at how people shop. So there is a massive, massive opportunity there. And then I think because these buyers because these companies understand their consumer much more, but are using digital as a first point of entry with that 10-year world change we talked about, then they can use that to drive platform advertising. They can use that to work on the right path forward. And you know, that's a rich experience. Again, as long as it's they're using that data respectfully and legally, and then they're making it in an effective targeting manner. That's a great story for platforms. And for scaling platforms outside some of the very traditional route of just Instagram or just Facebook, right? Yeah. There are many opportunities outside that, I think, for publishers in general, for native plays and products. There was the announcement this week of Outbrain and
Legatus,
combining as an emerging opportunity. There's a lot of opportunity for those, for platforms to enable people to manage that direct consumer relationship in a much broader sense. So I think it's a super interesting time. Big investors, that as a market segment has got a lot of disruption about it.
It's fast. It's all areas. I mean, we've got 750 companies in our DTC index, and obviously the DTC Daily, which is our publication that covers direct-to-consumer companies globally, has had a phenomenal start. And they basically have put most of their spend into Facebook and Google, right? AdWords and Instagram and Facebook in general. And I think ad tech has kind of been blindsided by this. I mean, like, you could argue that this is not a real thing, but it is a real thing, right? Because it's just, as I said before, the coalescing of many, many trends, particularly around behavior,
consumer behavior,
which we talked about in the streaming example, and the rise of the platforms, you know, the fulfillment platforms and the e-commerce platforms like Alibaba and Amazon, and the media platforms like Google and Facebook. We cannot, as the 20%ers, ignore this growth in these companies, because there's going to be literally hundreds of thousands, as you said, Simon. They are disrupting everywhere. They're disrupting insurance. They're disrupting pet food. They're disrupting commerce, banking, everything. Like, legacy brands that have taken consumers for granted for many, many years are being disrupted by smart, data-driven CEOs, founders, who've seen gaps in the market to have a direct relationship with users, right? And you're 100% right. Because of GDPR and because of the whole privacy thing, we can't be just cookie bombing people. We have to have a one-to-one relationship. And these companies do not have to build massive market share, right? They can take a small slice and have a phenomenally
and still be hugely
profitable business.
Yeah.
And so Third Love is interesting because they're servicing a part of the market that's been completely ignored, right?
Yep.
We're not all the same fucking size because we're misshaped. Some of us are tall, some of us are small. Some of us are big, some of us are not, right? Everybody comes in different shapes and sizes. And companies like this are addressing what consumers want.
And what's interesting is they're also doing that in an environment, like you say, which is profitable. It's making it profitable for them, so that they're able to balance that. And they're also managing to produce those products at to some degree at scale, because the reason that things became, that sizes became so sort of modified was because, for example, if you take shoes, you know, even when I was a child, you used to be able to buy shoes in different widths, and then shoe producers just stopped doing that. Yeah. Because it was too difficult to, it was too difficult for them to produce so many widths because they weren't sure they were going to sell them.
And
it was too
difficult. As a wide footer, I know what you mean.
There you go.
I've got that same problem as well.
But and also stores couldn't hold onto the stock. Right, because they also weren't sure how much of the, you know, wide foot versions they'd need. But of course, you know, brands like Third Love don't need to worry about that because they are literally providing their customers with what they want and what they need. So that entire relationship of how they get it made, what it looks like, how they store it, how they get to the customer is completely different from the old-fashioned, old-school retail.
So this is
high street store model.
This is life digital transformation. And my background, spent some time at Microsoft. Microsoft, I think, as a company, have done an amazing job on this, as have actually the likes of Amazon, Google, many other big companies. But actually, provision of things like cloud computing, the ability to and services that enable data manipulation at scale, leads us to this just-in-time delivery type methodology, right? Huge problem for this country right now with Brexit coming, because actually, our food supply chains are now based on technological investments in just-in-time delivery. Mm. And DTC is really the logical extension of that improvement in the whole supply chain. And big disruption within it as well. But I just think the opportunities are endless, right? And it is about servicing your customers. Customers probably wanting more direct relationships. And then being able to manage that all the way through. But there still is scale to it, right?
Yeah.
There still is an element of scale. And so
but it's the ability to build those segments.
These guys
and they've found a way to scale for customised goods, which is amazing.
I mean, you look at Facebook, right? I know we rail against them at all a lot on the media sites. But from a brand's perspective, it's just a godsend of a platform because you can build segments so easily and so granular. You could build an audience literally in a month. And actually service that audience. The biggest issue, we're probably going to want to know another story about out of home, is like, how do you build brand longevity, you know? You could have 100 mattress companies, but how do you build a real brand? And I guess that's the cool thing about this. And I'm finding myself kind of like looking at legacy media, like, and I put that in inverted commas because that's unfair because they're doing a lot of data-driven stuff in those areas. But TV and out of home, right? Traditional channels now are becoming perfect
vehicles, yeah.
And I actually think this DTC, the rise in DTC, is actually changing behavior within those companies and how they cater for these data hungry, analytics driven
those campaigns.
Yeah,
I agree.
It's really like this is a, as you say, massively transformation, because remember, these guys don't use agencies, right? So we've a whole middle layer that now is not going to be like CPGs could probably keep growth going, but all they want to do is cut back in marketing to their own demise, right? Because ultimately, it's death by a thousand cuts, right? There might not be these CPG brands around in 10 years because they just won't become, they won't be fit for purpose to have a listed company, and like stockholders are expecting growth. And if growth stalls, then they'll sell parts of the business off and break up the business, right? So you see that all mega mergers, which then will probably become split out. But it's an interesting trend because the next 10 years we're going to see these companies go from like two-man shops to like IPO companies who are built for the next generation. So,
again, interesting in that there's never one route to market, and I think brewing's quite an odd industry to make a comparison with, but craft brewing, massive explosion in the last 15 years, right?
Good point.
But actually, who owns most of the really successful craft brewing brands now? Also, what have those CPG companies done? They've moved to creating their own craft brewed beers that they run within their own supply chain.
Yeah. Mm.
Still getting some of the economics. So I wouldn't quite
dismiss
write
them
off the
out of
CPGs.
Hand. No.
I think they'll play in the space. They will actually adapt their mark, their own product strategy to
possibly
the
because
that
will be that's a route to exit as well.
And that will be
strategic acquisitions.
That will be a business transformation tool for them, really.
Yep.
That's what we've spoken about in a previous podcast, actually, is DTC is a business transformation tool. Very helpful segue into the third and final news story of the day, which is that British tights brand Heist have launched an out-of-home billboard campaign across the UK to announce their first shapewear collection. So this is exactly what you were just referring to, Kieran. Really interesting, you know, challenger DTC brand that's built an audience through typical social media channels, whether that's Facebook, Instagram, or other mechanisms, and now when they're coming to the point where they really want to scale and they really want to, you know, sort of cement their brand, they're returning to more traditional channels. A little bit similar to Harry's Razor campaign, featuring Harry Kane recently, the TV advert.
Is Harry's Razors owned by Harry Kane?
Maybe.
Try saying that several times over that, early in the morning.
There's a lot of that kind of lending your brand to a brand. You know what I mean? Like Harry Kane becomes the spokesperson for a couple of points of equity in the company. Like,
absolutely.
You know?
The thing I think is really...
Which is smart.
What I love about that, just from a branding point of view, is Gillette's great, successful marketer, great marketer in many ways, right? But how much of their marketing has been about sports faces?
Yeah.
Mm. So for Harry's, to Harry's brand, is a great slight subversion of the model.
Yeah.
Whilst moving up that funnel. I think it's just a great bit of work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right? And it's about where these people can migrate. There's no reason if you launch as a DTC, if you're a DTC business and you launch via digital channels, you shouldn't be limited to digital channels.
Absolutely.
Right?
That's
and if
what
you've
these
got
brands are
scale
proving.
Or investment or the right opportunity... Or indeed your audience isn't, you know, you build your audience initially via a digital route,
yeah.
But your audience isn't, your wider audience or your expansion isn't accessible. Of course you move. Mm. Of course you move to outdoor. Of course you move to radio, actually.
Yeah.
There's a really interesting, you know, audio opportunity is a really interesting opportunity for reaching certain segments of audience that aren't necessarily addressable. We talked about the OTT move as well. So more and more of media will become addressable via the digital channels. In general, right? So digital out of home is a big emerging opportunity. There is a lot of work to do in it, don't get me wrong, but a screen is a screen regardless of where it is. And actually, it doesn't have to be the traditional 48 sheet or whatever. That's about as much as I know about out of home, by the way. but it can be the ad in your newsagent.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of movement in this space about how you reach audiences at different places if you're a data-rich company. And I think... emergence in digital out of home will help. Emergence in digital audio will help,
yeah.
And actually on OTT or on VOD services,
yeah.
That's about consumers becoming digital in the main. Okay, in terms of this brand and this move, I think it sounds like it's a great time move with a good opportunity, right? And they've clearly identified an audience. I'm an old media boy. I started as a TV buyer. Mm. TV is great at some things, mm. Right? It should. We sometimes in our industry like to talk about digital versus TV. We've got to talk about it all together. That's part of a mix.
Yeah.
I live an increasingly digital life, but I still don't lead just a digital life.
We still listen to the radio, podcasts, and what?
Only this podcast.
Absolutely.
Excellent answer, son.
I find it interesting. Like, I find, like, I'm like you, right? So our journey is interesting, right? From Exchange Wars' point of view, we always were deep in the weeds of ad tech, right? We're digital first, we're data driven, but looking at from the world of a brand like the DTC brands that we talk to, right? It's just interesting how they view the world, and I think the out of home guys have been working really hard. The vendors, JCDecaux, Experian, Clear Channel, have been working really hard to build data aspects to out of home, traditional out of home, and obviously digital out of home, yeah. Right? And I think the conversations I had with these companies, they're really excited about these new challenger brands because there's no agency between them, right? So the conversation can be, it's a conversation where you don't have a middleman, right? They can talk to the brands. The brands are saying, look, we love this. We think it could work, but we want to have some data aspect to it because we have to build it into our attribution models, right? If we spend X, we're going to have a Y output, right? So they're trying to work really hard with them. And I think there's a massive opportunity for these companies to tap into this whole new money. And Facebook and Google are actually aggressively trying to contain those brands, to spend more money with them. And the brands are going, no. Because regardless of how good you are and how skilled you are, out-of-home and TV are the perfect branding models for our business, right? And brand is the next, you know, when they build their audience, but if you've got 10 competitors doing the same thing you are, you need
you
to have
need
an
to
identity,
establish your
right?
brand, yeah.
You have to think, like, Harry's razors, like Harry Kane, right? Perfect. That's like, you know, that's like brand recall. Like, you know, we're going to go in and potentially, you know, I don't really shave because I have a beard. I'm too lazy. But I'm sure there's a lot of people going, oh, Harry Kane, you know, he likes Harry's razors. Like, you know, he's an England hero. He scores goals. I like him. I'm going to buy the razors. So like that's a, but they're using TV and out of home as a vehicle to push that. So it's actually what was old is new again. It's like the most exciting parts of our industry right now are out of home. Out of home, remember, is a £1 billion industry in the UK spend. That's a very significant amount of money. In the US, it's 9 times as big. It's 9 billion. Globally, it's multi billion. And it's very interesting because they're, you think it'd be a kind of stodgy, old school media business, but they're actually quite open about what they're trying to do. They're really trying to do some stuff around data driven stuff.
And heavy on creative as well. Yeah. So, you know, actually.
They're building the creative and data layer, which is quite interesting.
Which is what's interesting, right? So, the heist out of home campaign is really creative, really imaginative, and very captivating. And, you know, if we all think about. You know, the sort of ads that we've ever had, sort of positive experiences with, the ads that we've loved, it's always been because they've had fantastic creative stories behind them, right? And, you know, we still have this conversation, don't we, in ad tech, how does the creative and kind of data technology layer interface? Well, maybe we're seeing a really good example of where they're actually getting it right, enough data injected into the creative process to know exactly who your audience is and some really impactful kind of traditional channels, but using that creative, sort of license within those channels.
I think this also just comes back to that, just the emergence of a digital world. And that sounds odd, 30, 40 years into it or whatever. But actually, if you think about things upcoming like 5G, right, like the speed and the quality and depth of content, there's always been limitations on what digital can deliver out of home. Well, actually, a fixed site can help. That's why actually a digital out-of-home site can work well. It's a fixed site. You can pre-deliver to it. You complete the auction. You can use injection for the video ad, so it's already preloaded. Mm. You can get past a number of issues, right? I think just that whole change in how people are able to consume and interact with advertising means advertising is much less about just the screen you're holding in your hand or you're typing into. And those canvases outside, there's Verizon in the US have towers out on the street, right, which are wireless masks. But they have advertising opportunities. We have an advertising and digital out-of-home business in the US that's built on these stations. And where people consume media is changing constantly. And that's going to be driven for these rich companies, that, you know, sorry, data-rich companies, I hope they're rich too, to execute and lean in. And that's where things develop. And again, you and I, Kieran, have spoken a lot about it. Hopefully we get a little bit further away from talking about programmatic and we just talk about interaction with consumers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's... I think the data-driven aspect is reaching these channels there, right? And it's really interesting to see what they're going to go do next with it. Because I think they've always worried about how they're being sold into the bigger brands by the agencies, because obviously the agencies are, you know, they have their own sort of agenda in many ways, like, you know, but if you look at Experian, right, and you sit on a train, Experian are doing all the advertising for the underground, you look at the amount of DTC brands advertising on the tube, yeah, and you realise that they wouldn't be spending money if it isn't working.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
For sure.
I mean, there's 2 points on that. One is I don't think consumers care whether it's a DTC brand or a big corporate brand.
Yeah, yeah.
No, they're just interested in the product, right? Or not. Yeah.
So there's no distinction for them.
Absolutely, but I'm just talking about the digital force brands are thinking in
outside.
A way that, yeah, they're thinking more progressively about old channels than established brands are, if you know what I mean.
For sure. And I also think that just in people's experience of all of these things, it's just much simpler these days, actually, to execute. And so I think the opportunity is removing some of the opaqueness that exists in the whole digital advertising model. If we're talking about the, you know, the beauty of Facebook and Google to a degree, Google search for sure, is that they're scaled platforms themselves.
And they're so easy to use. I mean, right. Facebook have done an unbelievable job building a UI, which is so simple to use. I mean, I'll give you an example. We run ads in Japan, and they're phenomenally successful for events, and we run a Japanese copy, and they work, right? We do granular targeting around Japanese digital marketing. And it's like, how is this so easy? This is like, imagine if I went through trying to run a campaign, a display campaign through a display agency in Japan. Imagine the leaps and bounds you'd have to go through there. Like, but it's right. If we can, I think this is one of the criticisms of our industry. If we can make things easier, particularly for these new generation brands, we will see more money flow into the space.
Yeah.
But I also don't see this necessarily as a challenge to an agency, right? I worked, 11 years ago, maybe a bit longer, at All Response Media, just down the road from us here, right?
Yes.
Really good agency.
What Great
did they,
company.
What did they do? They went and found consumer companies who wanted to advertise.
Yeah.
Right? They were one of the early leaders in direct response TV in this, which is still a massive opportunity.
Yeah.
So all we're really talking about is those opportunities as consumption shifts.
Yeah. Mm. And there's one of the ideas that I'm floating to people going, like, there is a big outlay to spend on digital out of home. So imagine if there's going to be companies who are going to aggregate that demand among 100 brands and give them a UI which is analytics driven and some kind of like some way to track the spend and the success of their spend. I think that's the probably gap that a lot of those out-of-home supply companies struggle with right now. But there's going to be... I'm very excited because there's a ton of opportunity for new companies. Like our response, why can't there be more of those for emerging channels like radio and out-of-home and digital out-of-home? It's very exciting, actually, because I think like there is a negative glaze around industry, you know, particularly around ad tech and, you know, the SSP layer and the DSP layer, and there's contraction and... That's inevitable, right? But the opportunities of taking those skills from our industry, our ad tech industry, and applying them
elsewhere
because the opportunities are vast. Out of home is huge.
Yeah.
There's an interesting thing we should consider in this just as a debate for everyone. I chair the IAB Europe Programmatic Trading Committee, and we do some research every year, so I'm just going to quick plug for that as well. It'll be out fieldwork in May, Attitudes to Programmatic Survey. That last year showed a real concern about talent. Because one drain that happens with more DTC companies, the skills to operate are then being pulled and spread thinner. How do you develop the training skills as a DTC brand or as an in-house, where in-housing occurs? That is actually going to be an ongoing challenge. Anything that's disruptive does offer the opportunity for emerging players, right? Training opportunities offers agencies to pivot and change a function of their business to better support it. But it's also... We've got to be super careful about talking about this thing as a whole-scale movement. It's an individual brand-by-brand choice. Where do I get more control in my conversation about how my digital is bought? Where do I take more control myself? And again, programmatic is not an old industry, right? Because it's not even an industry. It's a subpart of digital. Digital is actually not that old an industry, right? We are still evolving. TV buying is still evolving. Marketing is an old industry, right?
But, yeah. Mm.
Radio. So I just think we're in that puddle.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
Okay.
It's fascinating.
Thanks very
stuff.
Much. It is fascinating stuff. Clearly lots of opportunity. Clearly going to be a topic of conversation.
A lot of opportunity ad
this
tech.
Year, I would say. Okay. So moving on to the second part of our podcast session, which is a bit more of a focus on you, Simon, and what you're up to at Verizon Media. Tell us a little bit about what's on your agenda at the moment.
So it's a really exciting year for us, right? We've come out this year as Verizon Media. So we changed name at the end of last year. That for us is about building deep relationships with consumers but via our publisher technology and how we advertise and transact with them and how we develop a richer model with them. So we've talked about SVOD in this service. We look at original content. We also look at where we can provide subscription services to people for our user base. And so... For the whole company, it's a super interesting emerging year. I think there's a lot around creativity. There's a lot around content production. We're investing in actually building our own content production facilities and producing more and more original in-house content. We're a publisher. We're an ad tech player as well. Me, I'm a little bit more focused to that ad technology side. So last year, we relaunched Oath Ad Platforms. We consolidated our DSP down to a single stack, and that's getting real traction in market. We're seeing... really strong growth. And again, tying into this conversation, moving into some of these emerging areas with integrations for audio opportunities, the ability to deliver more native-like opportunities across other native providers and our own in-house native solution. So it's a really exciting year, actually. Some of the point of bringing companies together is past. We're seeing that development and path move forward. On the supply side, we're still completing some of that work, but we're pretty much there. So we see a real opportunity for us ahead in the next year. In the last couple of weeks, we've released some new ad formats, some new actual e-commerce styled units that make it easier for brands to come and advertise in, speaking to this DTC space, right? The ability to create creative. And we're evolving some interaction for game app providers so that people can demo their games via an advert via our publication. So, I mean, it's really, really exciting and pretty expensive.
It is a shame, though, that there is a lot of negative press around the Oath saga, if you will. Like, and I find it hard to kind of to stomach, because I actually think one thing that you guys have probably over most of your competitors is the amount of like owned and operated properties you have. Like, you see, you own like HuffPo and TechCrunch and Yahoo Mail and Yahoo Finance. You've got some really, really excellent brands and still drawing people to it. And actually, if you look at your ad tech stack, okay, it's been a mishmash because you've acquired a lot of companies, but you've gone through a painful integration process where you're going, one platform rules them all, right? So I think the Verizon's getting to the point where they have all their ducks in a row. And given the fact that we're moving more and more towards a first party world, it's the properties that you have that could be quite more advantageous to you, because a lot of your ad tech competitors do not have that consumer facing relationship.
For sure. I mean, look, we have when we talk to other publishers, we can talk from the actual experience of being a publisher. Mm. We know the challenge. We were really strict on things like GDPR because we felt that was the appropriate implementation, right?
You've got all in it. Like, you have to, you go to TechCrunch, just as a one page stop. Like, and it probably pisses people off, but it's probably made you so solid.
Well,
in
also,
that area.
I think for us, people are probably used to it now.
We just want to be really, consistent and appropriate and behave in the way that we feel we should as the size company we are and the company we are. And we want to be transparent in how we work with our consumers. And I think that's where you'll see even some of that change around, we may start offering non-ad funded models, right, to people if that's the thing they require. We will always explore in those areas. We do run this whole host of great brands. So HuffPost, TechCrunch, Yahoo and Yahoo brands within that, the AOL
Yahoo
brands themselves, Yahoo Sports, original content being produced in some of those areas, original content in finance, really rich heritage, stuff we can also draw on globally, which is actually really valuable from the US and investment there. And then we have our own Riot Studio, which does some really amazing work, has won Cannes Awards, has done VR video very early in some of the VR space. And as you think about where the industry is going, I genuinely see massive opportunity for us. I do think we've been a fun company to bash a bit as well in the past. And it's a complicated integration. But for me, the great thing this year about being Verizon Media is we can almost leave that behind. And we're out with this simple, straightforward message. And I think my message to everyone is, if you ever want to talk to us, we can have lots of different conversations with you. We'll work with you to identify, to have that right conversation for you as a brand, or an advertiser, or an agency, or a publisher, how we can support and monetize you. So we have, because we're a big organization, we have teams that focus into those areas, right? Because we can't, paper on the floor, sorry, everyone. we can't be everywhere. But there's a really good example. The bit of paper I just dropped actually was my crib notes about, we've just released the Verizon Ads SDK, a new SDK, ties into IAB SDK initiatives, so monetizing apps across all of our different services. So that's the exciting bit for me, actually. I think this year people will see much more new from us.
Yeah. And sounds like you've sort of come out of a period of, a bit of turmoil, a lot of change.
Yep.
And things have kind of internally consolidated to the point where you can actually focus on getting those products out to customers and articulating your proposition.
Yeah, and I think you'll see at the start of the year at CES, talked about an extended partnership with Microsoft, right? So we've had a long-term relationship with Microsoft from the AOL days. That's extended. That's extended into native opportunities. That's also extended the overall term of that agreement. So strategic partnerships is a route. I think we're a big business that's multifaceted. So you're going to see lots of different plays from us, some specific to our ad technology, to Oath Ad platform, some in the publishing space, and lots of different models. Hopefully, some experiments as well.
It's interesting. I'm just interested though. This is a kind of a left field question regarding sort of the business as a whole, right? We've seen lots of chat from people about shrinking IO models. But as a publisher and as a sort of third party ad tech, are you seeing more and more money shift from IO into programmatic? Because I'm hearing a lot of noise from people saying the agencies are basically starting to wind down a lot of the IO business. Less and less vendors are partners, and a lot of that money is going into PMPs or programmatic IO, programmatic guaranteed. So are you seeing that shift from as a publisher and ad tech company?
Yeah, so both the previous companies that came together to form Verizon Media were all early-ish into programmatic.
Yeah.
So we've always had a big programmatic base. So we've always been part of that conversation and access to inventories via that channel. We do see it driven sometimes by agencies, often by clients as well. And it's often about more flexibility in their buying and adjusting approach. I do think we probably see some decrease in just general branding. We've talked a lot about brand today. Well, actually, a lot more people are moving to a more direct response model consistently, an outcome-based model. So that has an impact on how people are placing orders, to a degree how much people will upfront. But again, that's not there's a healthy business there. I think we can overstate the doom and gloom on it. There's a significant business on IO opportunity. And then if you come back to what I just said about Riot Studios particularly, we do in-depth creative work. We bespoke content for partners. That, by default, that's never going to be, and I genuinely would go as far as never going to be, a programmatic opportunity. And that's still worth the investment from brands. We've done award-winning work with Velux in the out of the Nordics last year. I think that won a Cannes Award. So that's a good example where we can do many, many different things. So there is some shift for sure. I do think some of that is mandated by clients, and some of that's about control. But I think it's something we're managing in our own business model effectively.
And I was going to ask, actually, because your role's focused on EMEA. So yes. I was just going to ask if there are some things that are at forefront of your mind in the world of European ad tech in the coming little while. I mean, we sort of briefly touched on Brexit concerns. Then yeah. We're looking at more data privacy. I know some of that's been kicked into the long grass.
So for me, GDPR is I'm glad I talk about it much less this year.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? Because it was all anyone would ask me to talk about last year.
We were really obsessed last year.
Well, it was like the end of the war, wasn't it? Like, everybody before May was like, oh my God, the industry's doomed.
And I think most people have found paths and ways through it.
Yeah.
And again, individual companies making their own choice. I'm really comfortable with what Verizon's done all the way through that.
Mm. You'd be consistent, though.
We've been consistent. We saw impacts within that model, but we've seen strength come back, and yeah. We've refined and evolved. And,
yeah.
But actually, I think this year is a big year for regulation as the legal challenges start to
roll out.
And that will just bring granularity. And you know, the IAB is still working on evolving that framework, so there could be big changes that come through that process.
Yeah.
I'm not involved in that. I just know about it from a Verizon perspective. So I think regulatory pressure is going to be a big issue all year.
Yep.
Both from a privacy point of view. I think it's actually, the interesting thing is that's exporting out of Europe.
I was going to say, you know, the US are starting to pick up pace in terms of regulation.
And Brazil, I heard another suggestion of a local Brazilian version that's not dissimilar.
Same in Southeast Asia. Indonesians are looking to apply a GDPR copy and paste solution.
But where do you think this goes? Like, you know, we have a tech framework, and you guys have a consistent around opting in users to use of third-party cookies, but it seems increasingly that we are heading to a first-party war, regardless of what we think. Do you think that we'll start seeing, like, e-privacy is the next iteration of GDPR, or that's going to be the regulation, right? But unfortunately, well, it was supposed to be voted on this year, but there's elections now in July or June or July in the European Union, so that's likely not to happen next year. But e-privacy is pushing for users to use the browser to control the use of cookies. So do you think that would be the inevitable outcome of this, in the sense that we will use Chrome, or will we use Firefox, or will we use Safari to manage our privacy settings? I mean, it does seem to be logical, because if I opt in for third-party cookies, I'm not going to see pop-ups because I've already made the decision, right, to do that.
So, I mean, I think some of the challenge with GDPR is it was originally envisaged to actually come in with e-privacy in the same month, right? So it's not even that it's late this year. The e-privacy was originally expected at the same time as GDPR. And that's some of the interpretation gap that exists today, is that some interpretations have assumed that things that were in the pipework are already in effect, de facto needed. And some other markets or companies take a view that they're not yet there, so you don't need to append to that position. I definitely don't want to get too deep into GDPR. With any European legislation, I think you have to wait and see what finally comes out of the work is probably my first point. I do think browser controls are definitely part of that path forward.
Yeah. It seems logical, though.
It does seem logical. And I think from as a publisher, we want to respect what users are signalling around consent is probably the first point I'd make. So if that becomes the evolution of the industry, that's what we'll look to support and signal. We have been big supporters of the IAB framework, and we continue to be. And I think that's a good method for the broader internet to manage those relationships and to interact. Yeah. I don't know. I think it's interesting you mentioned the level of sort of blindness to the consent. Consent is a really emotive topic, particularly for legislators, right? Versus your average bill on the street. And so I think we'll just end up with a set of standards that we end up adhering to. Yeah. The interesting thing about that is some of the challenge also about what can and can't be tracked, right? And so impacts of IPT. And that comes to another regulatory question about where is the control and which companies have this control and where do they play? And I definitely
And how they wield that power, you know, particularly when they have big ad businesses themselves or have a fairly large consumer-facing business, which has a downward effect on the rest of us.
Luckily, we've run out of time, so you're out of the hot seat.
There's another
Simon.
Hour. We can do another hour here.
I think that's for reserved for another podcast. So thank you very much, gentlemen. Thank you, Kieran. Thank you, Simon. And thanks very much for listening. That was the MedTech Podcast.